Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
And I'm James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com, and we both welcome you to a jam-packed episode of The New World Next Week, which, of course, you can find everything you need at NewWorldNextWeek.com. James, let's not hesitate any longer. Let's get to the good news and show folks that, yes, Portland remains fluoride-free. We'll take it from our own Portland Tribune. As Portland voters reject water fluoridation, there weren't too many smiles Tuesday night at the site of the election night party of the pro-fluoride campaign, whose main slogan was Help PDX Smile, PDX being a nickname of Portland. Measure 26-151 lost by a resounding 3-2 margin, the fourth time in five tries that Portland voters have turned down the idea of fluoridating the city's water supply. Quote, at a very fundamental level, people understand that we don't want more chemicals in our water, end quote, said Kim Kaminsky, leader of Clean Water Portland, at a campaign party for fluoride opponents. The nonprofit Upstream Public Health brought the idea of fluoridating Portland's water to the city councilors last year, quietly building majority support on the council before the public really caught wind of the fluoride issue, and it was all back on track in Portland. The council unanimously approved fluoridating Portland's water last September, but the stealth campaign by supporters may have backfired. Fluoridation opponents with little money or professional political help quickly gathered enough signatures to force a public referendum, which happened yesterday, May 21st. Rick North, member of Clean Water Portland's steering committee, said, quote, in 30 days, we put together an operation that gathered 43,000 signatures. Portland remains the last major city in the United States without fluoridated water, and now that the voters have spoken, yet again will remain so. James, we couldn't be very much more happy here in Portland, as myself and my amazing girlfriend were pretty well involved in this fight. And of course, like anything, not as much as you really want to be. I know the night before the vote, I was kind of wringing my hands thinking, man, I didn't do enough. I didn't do enough. We're going to lose. I didn't do it. But it all turned out, I think, pretty well. The interesting thing, James, is somebody, I think, there's a documentary film in this to be made. And I think our sort of local alternative press, I think, really kind of showed what they're all about. So here's the Willamette Week. You can't handle the tooth. Why the far right and left came together to defeat fluoride. And we also have the Portland Mercury here. The sanest arguments against fluoride and why they're all still wrong. So again, these are pretty much the youngish magazines that, you know, if we had investigative journalism, and we do a little bit here, they'd see that the community organizations were bought off. There's even new emails showing that the fluoride lobbyists leaned on state legislators, and even that's only just coming out in the last couple of days. So the interesting note is, you know, we'd ask, well, if there's any investigative journalists, maybe they could really kind of blow this story open wide. But I can't help be reminded of in 2008, a journalist for the Portland Mercury exposed our newly elected mayor's improper sexual relations, and her reward was a sweet job with that mayor. James, it would be like you deciding to take a job with Monsanto after you expose them. Go, oh, maybe I should just go work for them. We don't work that way, James. And I think this is a huge, resounding victory.
It is. It's a nice little victory for a change. So let's just bask in it for a little while. And this restores my faith in the people of PDX, who may buy into the hope and change Kool-Aid. But at any rate, they're drinking clean, fresh water for the time being. I'm glad this has happened. And I think, again, this is a testament to what can happen when people come together from the left and the right, the meaningless divide, to come together on issues of importance for everyone. And as exactly as you say, I think the important thing to take home from this is that the fluoride, the pro-fluoride side, was extremely well-funded and a political organization and all of that, and the anti-fluoride was completely grassroots, self-organized grassroots campaign that came together and managed to get the votes get the signatures for the referendum and managed to get it through. Just an incredible testament to what can be done when people really mobilize around an issue like this. So my hat's off to everyone in Portland who helped out.
And I would like to think too that, you know, not only did we win, but I'd like to think now that we'll be that bellwether for other cities to go, hey, we can do this too. And speaking of Monsanto, I think hopefully we can kind of take this momentum going into this Saturday, May 25th, the worldwide, if not international, march against Monsanto, which, James, you already talked to Tammy Canal, one of the head organizers. And again, my amazing girlfriend, Cassie Cohn, has been one of the co-organizers of the march here in Portland, which, judging just by the Facebook RSVPs, looks to pretty much be one of the largest marches against Monsanto in America this coming weekend, and yours truly might be running the sound. So we'll continue to cover all those stories. And again, I did pretty long, extensive bits on my Twitter account at Media Monarchy, so you can get all the blow-by-blows of the fluoride fight if you are interested. James, we discussed it before we started to roll tape here. There's really no easy segue into the next insane batch of stories, which today was probably the dominant story in the mainstream media. Panic on the streets of London. British soldier literally butchered on a London street. Woolrich attackers proclaimed an eye for an eye after the attack. And we will take this from The Telegraph. In the first terrorist murder on the British mainland since the 7/7 suicide bombings of 2005, men attempted to behead the soldier, hacking at him like a piece of meat in front of dozens of witnesses before both were shot by police, who took around 20 minutes to arrive. After the killing, one of the men, believed to be a British-born Muslim convert, spoke calmly into a witness's video phone. And these gruesome videos are out there for folks, and we can, of course, at least even just kind of show you some of the still images of what looks to be like we are living in a horror film. It emerged that passersby went to the soldier's aid. One of the killers ordered that only women could tend to the body, not men. And there were questions as to why it took around 20 minutes for armed police to arrive on the scene, during which time the killers calmly walked up and down the road, carrying their bloodied knives and a pistol, while members of the public confronted them. James, this is a truly bizarre scene, and I can't help but also maybe add in, as long as we're talking murder and mayhem, we've seen the recent stories of the Syrian rebel cutting out the soldier's heart and eating it. And again, I don't really know what to say. These are kind of ground zero style stories, James.
They are. And I think the important thing to note here is that, of course, they're going to try to apply the terrorist label to this. And they're assembling, you know, the political elite there in Britain to see how they'll respond to this. And the English Defense League is trying to spin it off into a more of the Clash of Civilizations BS that is used in all of these types of situations to, again, get the public fighting over the non-issues, where the real issue here is this is a murder and not a terrorist incident. It's absolutely galls me to think that a nation that could survive the Blitz, where literally 40,000 people in London died in 71 bombing raids or whatever it was, and they can go through that with a stiff upper lip and don't let it change your life, and yet one grisly murder on the street is going to apparently change the course of a nation. It's absolutely ridiculous, and it only exists because people buy into the fear and paranoia over all of this. So the only thing that people can do when it comes to this is to tune it out. It does not affect 99.9999999% of the people living in the UK, and it can only affect you if you let it. So once again, terrorism is all about the hype. It's all about what they show you. It's all about what they tell you. It's all about how they try to control your perceptions of the world rather than the way the world actually is. This is not a terrorist incident. This is a murder. It should be treated as such.
James, I wouldn't have mentioned it, but you really reminded me, because I was talking about this with folks earlier this week, as the horrific situation in Oklahoma here in the States, where massive tornadoes caused massive damage. But again, tornadoes hit Tornado Alley all the time. And fortunately, the death toll wasn't as nearly as high as they thought it was going to be. But what I was asking, it's like, man, we flip out at the smallest thing anymore. And I can only kind of compare it to Steven Spielberg's really bad film called 1941, which is about California the week after the Pearl Harbor attack, and how it's all basically about misguided terrorism. But you basically have a populace losing their minds at the drop of a hat. And every event now seems to be a wall-to-wall mainstream media story. They have to drop everything they're doing. CNN sets up camp, and that's where they are, and that's where they will remain. And these are those kind of strange stories that make we're completely overreacting over most things. And again, I don't want to be hateful. I don't want to be tasteless about any of this. But like you said, you got to always ask the question, how many people does this story actually affect? So, James, just in closing on these bizarre stories, I think we also saw today just the other bit of murder and mayhem, perhaps a little bit of cleanup operation in Florida as a man was shot dead by the FBI who knew the Boston bombing suspects, and he was allegedly connected to their 2011 slayings. And, James, I hope, like myself, a lot of folks out there are huge fan and follower of Lauren Coleman's work at copycateffect.com. This weekend is essentially the one-year anniversary of the Causeway Cannibal. That would be the Miami Cannibal incident, which was a huge event, which I can't help but notice in the realm of this London machete attack and this Syrian soldier event. I don't know, James, if you have any words on that.
Well, again, there is just some weirdness in the air at this point. But again, it's all about perception. So just don't let it affect your perception of reality. You should trust your senses rather than what you're seeing on TV.
That's it. You're exactly right, James. Our third and final story this week is going to blast us off into the future that we all live in right now. And we'll grab it from Reuters. And again, you can get it all on Twitter at Media Monarchy. Jury deliberations to begin in first case of 26 malpractice suits involving robot surgery. Jury deliberations are set to begin in the first case to go to trial of at least 26 lawsuits against Intuitive Surgical Incorporated, alleging injuries tied to its Da Vinci robotic system. Kitsap County Superior Court Judge Jay Roof in Port Orchard, Washington State, handed off the case to the 12-member jury yesterday after a five-week trial. Lawyers for the estate of Fred Taylor seek $8.45 million in damages based on claims that Intuitive is mostly to blame for his injuries stemming from a 2008 robot-assisted removal of his prostate gland. Taylor and his family allege he suffered because of Intuitive's inadequate training that was streamlined and compromised by the company's push to sell its robots. In robotic surgery, a doctor sits at a console several feet from the patient and peers into a high-def display. Foot pedals, hand controls, maneuver the mechanical arms and equipped with surgical tools, guided by a 3D camera that shows the work as it is done inside the patient. James, I could not help but immediately think of the story that I know we've referenced at least once before, and that would be The Onion's satirical stories about putting a drone on trial. And now as we see the admission today in the news of the Obama side admitting, oh yes, we kill Americans with drones. Now we're looking at essentially robots on trial, and this is the future, James.
Welcome to the future. Yes, absolutely. This is a bizarre story. In some ways, this particular story is not, I think, so big on the big scheme of things, but it is a part and parcel of that bigger thread that sees us through this to such things as the drone strikes. And again, you can laugh at it through The Onion's satirical take on it, but that's an actual question that has come up in some of the deliberations that are going on amongst the transhumanist advocates, etc. For example, IEEE has an article that I've referenced before called "Who is Accountable When Drones Kill?" And it's really asking the question about if a drone goes rogue, goes haywire, malfunctions, whatever the case may be, and ends up killing people, who is accountable for that? Can you hold the company that designed it to task for that? Or the people who were supposed to be maintaining that system? Are they legally accountable for the deaths that result from that? It is a bizarre field of inquiry that's unfortunately being made possible because of these types of technologies that are being implemented without almost any public debate whatsoever, so that, as you say, Holder can come out and say, oh yeah, by the way, we've killed four Americans with drone strikes. What are you going to do about it? Of course, that's not to say anything about the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of non-Americans who have been killed with drone strikes. Of course, they deserved it. It's just that, you know, now they're admitting, oh yeah, we also kill Americans without trial. We just drop bombs on them from the sky.
Mm-hmm. James, I suppose in a way, in closing, I'll somewhat apologize for the rather gruesome batch of stories this week, but let's again maybe like we've said, focus on the positive of the defeat of fluoride and also take that momentum and heading towards this weekend where, you know, I often look at, you know, these sort of protests of things as sometimes a dead paradigm. I don't know that I look at this march against Monsanto as a sort of, you know, hell no, we don't want your war. But ultimately, it's going to get a bunch of people together to start to talk about these issues. So I think in a way, it's not necessarily so much of like, yeah, the state's going to hear us. Because ultimately, when it comes down to it, like we've always said, if we can get those people to suddenly go, oh, all I have to do is not buy that crap. Now, granted, that's easier said than done, being here in Portland versus someplace like my home state of West Virginia. But again, we're starting it and the ball is rolling and it's only going to snowball, I think.
I think so, too. I agree. I think the march is about mobilization. I'm going to be covering it on Global Research TV, so you can stay tuned for that. But also, just on that note of what people can do about this, I'll just note that I recently retweeted one of your tweets about an app that you can download now to implement boycotts by scanning your groceries as you go to buy them to see where, you know, what companies it's actually related to. And there's people who complain about that particular app, but it's just one idea of what we can do to actually use technology in a positive way to enable us to implement those types of boycotts and boycotts, which both can be effective. At any rate, that's going to do it for this week. So once again, James, thank you so much for the stories and congratulations on your fluoride-free water.
Thanks so much, man. Take care.